In the old Christian hymns, number two books that Mark and I sang out of growing up, maybe some of the rest of you, on the song, Jesus Loves Me, there was a note that said, the favorite hymn of China. I doubt that's the case today, but I'm glad there are still people today who know that Jesus loves them, and I thank Jason for singing that. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 5. We're going to begin with a reading of verses 33 through 37. We're working our way through Christ's first official sermon, if you will, the Sermon on the Mount. And we're down to verse 33. Christ says, again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, neither by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Now last week, in verses 27 through 32, we were talking about the sixth commandment, and talking about marriage and divorce. And I think the principle that comes out of that paragraph is that prevention is better than cure. To avoid adultery, to avoid the breakup of a marriage, it is better to take preventative measures. Any feeling, any thought that can tend toward impure thoughts, that can be threatening to a marriage, needs to be plucked out, cut off, amputated, crucified, exterminated. That's the kind of language that Christ uses. He says, if you look upon a woman to lust after her in your heart, pluck out your eye, cut off your right hand. Now that sounds pretty extreme, but I think the extremity of the figures Christ uses of pulling out your eye and cutting off your hand is meant to say something about the danger involved here. That language reminds me of when Gary was a little baby and just starting to crawl. This was down when I was preaching in Louisville, south of Louisville, and I'm sitting in my chair one day and he's crawling around the room and he crawls up to an electric outlet. And he starts to put his finger into the outlet. And I just went ballistic, intentionally so. I yelled, I screamed, I jumped up, I ran over, I grabbed him, I snatched him away. I was trying to impress him with the thought that sticking your finger into electric outlets a bad idea. And apparently it worked because Gary hadn't electrocuted himself yet. So when you have a reaction like that, it's because the danger is great and you're trying to avoid experiencing that danger. Marriage is never to be entered lightly. Marriage is never to be entered hurriedly, but once the knot is tied, those involved, the husband and wife, should do everything they can to make sure that knot never comes untied. For that to happen, love must rule all. There must be mutual understanding involving unselfishness and patience. The husband is to honor the wife. 1 Peter 3:7. The wife is to respect the husband. And as each pays attention to their responsibility, as husbands honor wives, putting them on a pedestal, as wives respect husbands, they bring out the best in each other. They encourage the other to do even more than before. Kipling, when he was a young man in India, just starting to write his poetry, wrote a poem that was published that drew the praise of Lord Alfred Tennyson, thought to be the greatest poet in England at that time. Tennyson praised his poem. And when Kipling heard that, he said something like this. He said, well, it's not right for the private who is praised by the general to presume upon that relationship, but the private will fight harder in the next fight. When we are praised, when we do our job, that encourages the one we're helping to fight even harder. And that's the way it ought to be in a marriage. We're to bear one another's burdens. And when you bear another's burdens, you are carrying something they no longer have to carry. And it's important to remember that when you are bearing another's burdens, they don't have to worry. They don't need the anxiety or the stress involved in carrying that, because now you are carrying that for them. That's to happen in a marriage. And in a marriage, we lovingly correct each other's thoughts out of a respect by the conduct we've shown in the marriage. And above all, we draw near to the throne of God and ask Him for His blessing. So Christ had a great deal to say about the sixth commandment and the marriage relationship. And now, in the passage I just read, we're going to the third commandment. This is Christ's official sermon, so to speak. And He's not dealing with trivialities here. Every subject He mentions here is important. Anger, which is the opening that the devil uses to destroy souls and relationships. And then marriage. And now He's going to talk about the third commandment. And that may not be obvious at first glance, because unlike the sixth and seventh commandment, He doesn't quote the third commandment. Rather, He quotes a passage from Leviticus 19:12 to say, "You have heard that it was said of old, you shall not swear falsely." That's Leviticus 19. Well, how do we get to the third commandment in the statement, "You shall not swear falsely"? Just this way. To swear is to invoke the name of God. And I don't just mean the name Jehovah or Jesus Christ. To swear is to invoke God in all that He is. To bear witness to something. And the third commandment says, "Thou shalt not take the name of thy Lord in vain." And so when we swear, we're invoking God's name. If we swear falsely, if we forswear ourselves, if we say something that's not true, if we make a promise we're not intending to keep, we have taken the name of God in vain. And that's how the third commandment comes into all of this. And so we're going to talk about what's involved here. And what's involved here is truth. All that Christ says about swearing and oaths is involving truth. And Christ follows His usual outline that we've seen thus far in the sermon, where He talks about the Jewish corruption of a command of God, and then He talks about His Christian correction. And so in verses 33 through 36, He's talking about the Jewish corruption of something God said. And then in verse 37, He's going to give the Christian reaction, the Christian behavior that He expects of us. So let's first talk about the Jewish corruption, about how they were handling oaths and swearing that was wrong. By the word swearing, I'm not talking about cussing. Yeah, you know, just using filthy language. By swearing, I'm talking about taking an oath or taking a vow. When you swear in that sense, you are making an appeal to God. You're calling upon God to listen in on something you're saying. Now, why would men ever need to make an appeal to God in conversation with each other? Why would they have to bring God into the equation? Well, because Hebrews 6:16, men are really good at lying. Men are really good at deceiving. Even in telling a half-truth, you could really be telling a lie. Men are good at prevaricating. I'm not telling the entire truth. And because men are such good liars, white lies, every color of lie, beyond white, because we are such good liars, in ways that maybe even be innocent. Have you ever laughed at a joke you didn't understand? But by laughing, you were kind of giving off the impression you understood and you thought it was funny. You know, even in simple ways like that, We're really good at lying. And so what Hebrews 6 tells us is that men require of other men oaths. They may not be able to tell if you're lying or not. So they want you to call God as your witness because He knows whether you're lying or not. And if you're lying, you're asking God to strike you dead. You're asking God to take vengeance on you, to deal with you because He knows if you're lying or not. And the hope is that men are concerned enough about going in to face God, knowing they've lied, taking His name in vain, that they won't lie, that they won't misstate the facts. The Old Testament told Jews to swear by the name of God. Swearing was not prohibited in the Old Testament. False swearing was, but swearing was not prohibited. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13, "You shall swear, you shall take oaths in the name of God." So God, realizing how easy it is for men to lie, how easy it is to deceive someone you're making a promise to, signing a contract with, God says, "No, you swear in my name, but having sworn in my name, you better keep it." Psalm 15 says, "Blessed is the man who swears to his hurt and changes not." Have you ever made a promise and something went wrong, and for you to keep the promise, you're going to end up holding the short end of the stick? You're going to take the hit? I didn't know how it started out, but that's how it ends up. "Blessed is the man that swears to his hurt, his disadvantage, and changes not." He keeps his word. He follows through on his promise. That's what God expected of the Jews. Now, here's the problem with the Jews. They had a law, the law of Moses, that required strict truth-telling, strict truthfulness. But over time, they created all kinds of loopholes. And in verses 34 through 36, Christ talks about those loopholes. Christ says, whoever swears, he says, "Don't swear by heaven, for it's God's throne. Don't swear by earth, it's His footstool." The Jews would not swear by God. They would swear by God's good earth. They would swear by God's temple. And Christ shows later in the Gospel of Matthew, they would even swear by the gold of the temple. To swear by the temple was one thing. To swear by the gold of the temple was something more. It's kind of like this. You make a promise to a guy and you tell him, "I swear on my mother's grave, you know, I'll keep my promise." And you hope the guy has enough respect and reverence for his mother that if he swears on her grave, he will actually keep the promise. But if he says, "I swear on my mother's vacuum," well, the vacuum may not be as sacrosanct as the grave. When I was a kid, if you did this while saying something, cross your fingers, that mean you could be lying. That could mean you have no intention of keeping the promise. You know, you tell a kid something, you have your hand behind your back, and if you give me a piece of candy, I'll do this. He gives you the candy. Ha ha! I have my fingers crossed. And you don't have to keep your part of the bargain. I don't understand all exactly what the Jews were doing, but they were creating loopholes. They were saying, "Aha, I had my fingers crossed," and they were not keeping their word. And Christ says, that has got to stop. It doesn't matter what part of this world you swear by, whatever part it is, it's here because God put it here. And to swear by anything in this world, including yourself, is to invoke God because He put you here. You rattle any link in the chain, you're rattling all the way to God. So Christ is insisting on being truthful. But then look at verse 37. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Now, there's a lot of misunderstanding, I think, about what Christ is saying here. His half-brother James in his epistle says the same thing. Let your yea be yea, your nay be nay. Does that mean that a Christian should never, under any circumstances, swear? If you're a Christian and you run for political office and you get elected, to take your office, you have to be sworn in. Would you be sinning as a Christian who gets elected to county dog catcher if you took the oath of office to fulfill that position? Is that what Christ is talking about here? You know, the very fact that we require politicians to swear to uphold the Constitution before they can take office says something about our trustworthy politicians we have. We have them all swear to it. Nobody is given a free pass. And of course, in courts, the courts have made an allowance. You don't have to swear, you can just affirm. You know, there isn't, the difference between swearing and affirming doesn't amount to spit on the griddle. In both cases, you're saying, I can be trusted, I'm trustworthy, you can believe me. In both cases. And the word you use does not change the action involved. Is Christ saying that a Christian should never swear under any circumstances? My answer to that is no, that is not what he's saying. How do I know that's not what he's saying? I know that because the Apostle Paul on several occasions swore. He didn't cuss, he swore. He invoked the name of God to convince people he was writing to of the truthfulness of what he was saying. Here's a couple of examples. Romans chapter 1 verse 9. Paul writes to the Romans and says, "For God is my witness." And then he tells them what he has to say. Why didn't he just tell them what he had to say? He says, "God is my witness." And in invoking God, that constituted by definition swearing. Galatians chapter 1 verse 20. "Before God, I do not lie." That's the same as saying, "I swear to God, I am telling you the truth." Again, God understands that we can't trust each other. He understands that there are times and situations and occasions where a higher appeal to our veracity is called for. And Paul at times would make an appeal to a higher authority. He would appeal to God to verify the truthfulness of what he was saying. And the clincher on this matter of swearing is in Hebrews chapter 6, when the writer said that God, wanting to confirm to Abraham the immutability of the promise that he had made to Abraham, swore by himself. There are times in the Bible when God would say something, it's going to be like this or that, and then later change his mind, and it wasn't like this or that. But when God would swear to something, on the rare occasions that he did, whatever he swore to was immutable. It was going to happen regardless of what cropped up after that. And so he swore to Abraham, "I swear to you that I'll make of you a great nation." And there were times in the history of the Jews after that, God wanted to completely wipe out the nation of Israel. God would wipe out other nations for doing less than the Israelites were doing. Why didn't he ever wipe out Israel? Because he had sworn to Abraham, "I'm going to make of you a great nation, and from your nation, from your descendants, is going to come the one to bless the whole world." God swore to David, "To you and to your sons I give the right to rule over Israel forever." But David's sons, his descendants who sat on the throne, got so bad that God finally said, I cannot stomach the sons of David anymore. And he took them off the throne and for, what, about 600 years ruled Israel through Gentiles. But he never revoked his promise to David. And thus it was in the days of Augustus, when Herod was king, that a son of David was born who was raised up to sit at the right hand of God. God would swear by himself, and when he did, it was set in concrete. God recognizes that there are times in life, like giving testimony in a trial, like taking public office, things like that, in which appealing to a higher authority, and because he could appeal to no higher authority than himself, he swore by himself, the Hebrews writer said, but we can appeal to a higher authority, and at such times, there's nothing wrong with us condescending to the requirements of human fallibility and increasing the sanctity of a promise that we make. Let your yes be yes and your no be no means we are to always speak the truth. There should never be any wobbliness or wavering in the word that we give and the promises that we make. And let's close by looking at three reasons why truth speaking is always right and proper and should be characteristic of the Christian. Number one, truthfulness is important because we have a duty to ourselves. Have you ever known someone not go to the doctor because they were afraid of what the doctor would tell them? We want to tell ourselves we're healthy, we're okay when we're really sick. So we stay away from the doctor, we stay away from any kind of test. And when we are unwilling to hear the truth about ourselves, we have put ourselves in extremely dangerous territory. Paul, to Timothy, talks about men who deceived and were being deceived. They were deceiving other people by their lies, but they were being deceived. And the biggest deception is that they started believing their own lies about themselves. At the end of World War II, when the German army had been all but wiped out by the Americans and the Russians, Hitler was still acting like he had armies here and there, and he was giving orders that were going out to armies that had been obliterated. He lied for so long, and the Germans, the Nazis, lauded lying as a means of controlling people. They did it so long and so often, they started believing their own lies, and they believed them till the day they committed suicide or were destroyed by the enemy. We owe it to ourselves. We have a duty to ourselves to be honest and truthful about our own situation. And a lot of people can block out the truth about themselves and live under a false self-assessment that has no bearing to reality. Secondly, we have a duty to tell the truth because of our responsibility to our society. Lying is an antisocial sin. It's a crime against humanity to lie. We've got a big problem in this country right now because people who are not citizens of this country are lying and claiming to be citizens, and they're changing votes and changing outcomes that they don't have any right or say in. And I don't know if the country will survive the lying that's going on in regard to whether we're citizens or not. Can you imagine what would happen to contracts? We make contracts all the time. You won't You want phone service, you contact the phone company and you agree to pay whatever the cost is every month. They come out and run the phone line to you, the fiber cable or whatever. But you're lying to them and you don't intend to pay them what you promised. For a while I had some rentals. Biggest mistake I ever made. I got rid of them, I'll never have them again. But people always paid the first month's rent. They promised to pay. They always paid the first month's rent, but in many cases, that was the only monthly rent you got. They knew they were lying when they made the promise. All of our occupations, all of our business transactions, all of our ordinary conversations depend upon us being truthful with other people. If everybody lied to everybody else, business could not be contracted, friends, neighbors could not be trusted, and society would dissolve into anarchy. We have a duty to our society, to our community, to tell the truth. And thirdly, we have a duty to tell the truth because of our obligation to God. He who is truth insists that we tell the truth. To walk in the light is to be like God in regard to truth-telling. And there are times we have to exercise tact. I mean, to tell a girl, when I look into your face, time seems to stand still, is not the same as looking at her and saying, when I look into your face could stop a clock. So we've got to be tactful. But we learn to be tactful without compromising the truth. So Christ in His sermon calls upon us to be committed to truth, to eschew lies. All liars, Christ says in the last book of the Bible, shall be cast into the lake of fire. Let's commit ourselves to truth. Let God be true and every man a liar.